So, Andrew Gallimore, good to see you again. We've, of course, known each other for many years, and I'm presently sitting here in the United Kingdom in the city of Bath on the 3rd of July, 2025, and you are sitting in Tokyo,
I
in
indeed.
Japan, 8 hours later than me in terms of time zones.
Yes.
And we're going to have a chat about your new book, Death by Astonishment, Confronting the Mystery of the World's Strangest Drug.
That's the one.
That's the purpose of the interview, and it's a fantastic book, and that's why I wrote the foreword for this book. It's, in my view, I'm going to give you a bit of a plug here, Andrew. It's an
Okay.
essential read. It's an essential read, but it's also a fun read for anybody who's interested in the mystery of existence, of what it is to be alive. It's an intriguing, thought-provoking read, and a really valuable contribution to any discussion around consciousness and the mystery of consciousness. Before we dive more deeply into this, I think it would be a good idea if you began by telling us what DMT is, because the strangest drug in your book's subtitle is
Yeah.
DMT, dimethyltryptamine. So, what are we dealing with here?
Well, you're dealing with a very common plant-derived molecule
Yeah.
that also just happens to be the most efficient molecular tool that we have for almost instantaneously obliterating the normal waking world and replacing it with one that is, well, not just strange, but incomprehensibly strange, that exceeds the imagination in its bizarreness, and a world that is populated, some would say teeming, crawling with what appear to be extremely advanced, intelligent, non-human, non-animal beings that you can communicate with. So if that's not the world's strangest drug, I'm not sure I'd like to try the real world's strangest drug.
And yet it's widely available in nature, you say.
Yeah, I mean it's a weird thing. When DMT was first discovered, well, when it was first identified as the active component, first of all, of the Yopo stuff, by Stephen Zara, this Hungarian physician back in 1956, and then Epeyna, this another type of snuff, and then finally it was the kind of the ayahuasca technology was uncovered. We worked out that DMT was the key component there, and after that people started finding DMT wherever they looked. Like botanists and chemists, they would do analyses of chemical analyses of plants, and they would find DMT in there, and the list seems to be endless. I mean, there are countless species now that we know contain various levels of DMT. So it's fair to say, I mean, Dennis, our mutual friend Dennis McKenna, always says nature is drenched in DMT, and he even speculates that it's probably found in all plants. If if you analyze it, and it's probably small levels in most, but
Has the
probably
work been done?
excellent.
Can anybody actually make a scientific statement to say why evolution has favored the presence of DMT so widely in nature? What is it? I mean, straightforward survival of the fittest evolutionary theory suggests it must confer some survival advantage, or does it? I mean, what's it doing there?
That's a very interesting question, and of course, scientists have speculated. Maybe it's to deter insects. There is, particularly psilocybin, for example, the re very closely related molecule from psilocybe mushrooms mainly. This is thought to interact with the nervous systems of insects. So perhaps it's deterring insects.
Has anybody done the work to say, oh, actually, this is what this is what this plant's production of, say, Cicotria viridis in the Amazon is producing DMT to deter insects, or has nobody done that work yet?
As far as I'm aware, I could well be wrong on this, but as far as I'm aware, no one's done that. And I think, you know, DMT, in many ways, it's not a particularly interesting molecule. It's a weird thing to say, but when you actually look at the molecule, it's simple. I mean, it's two enzymatic steps from tryptophan to tryptamine to dimethyltryptamine. It's two steps. It's simple. It's not, it's kind of boring when you compare it to some of the extremely elaborate and fascinating molecular architectures that plants make. DMT, it's kind of like, it looks boring, which is why it's so kind of remarkable that it actually, when it interfaces with the human brain, it has effects that are far from ordinary.
A thought that occurs to me at the moment you say that is, do we have any knowledge whether DMT interfaces in any remarkable way with non-human brains, with the brains of the higher apes, for example, or even with the brains of fish? Has that work been done?
Yeah, well, certainly with primates. I mean, in the 1950s and 60s, when DMT was first being studied, together with LSD and mescaline and bufotenine and other related molecules, DMT was injected into apes, and they're unable to.
They can't report their experiences
exactly. So it's kind of
in
like
the way that human volunteers can,
right?
So that would be even more difficult if it was injected into a fish.
But
again, we can't enter that inner experiential world of other animals, and actually we can't enter the inner experiential world of other humans either.
That's true. Yeah.
In a way. And you were talking earlier about how DMT efficiently disconnects us from the quote unquote real world and plunges us into a world filled with intelligent entities. I had surgery about 10 days ago, which involved a general anesthetic, and that certainly disconnected me from the real world. Within seconds, I mean, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, I was just gone, completely gone and nowhere, and until I woke up post-surgery. And there were certainly no entities inhabiting that disconnection from the real world. So there's obviously something very special going on with DMT, but at the same time, DMT is part of a class of tryptamines, which, if I'm correct, include psilocybin, include LSD. There's a range of differences in the way that these tryptamines work on people. Let's talk a little bit more about that. What makes DMT stand out from the rest of its family in terms of experience that we know about from the reports of human volunteers?
Yeah, I mean, all of the tryptamines that you mentioned, LSD is slightly different, but it has a tryptamine kind of within the molecule, embedded within it. But they all work via the same primary receptor. They all bind to the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor, which is an excitatory receptor, which means it stimulates neurons, makes them more active, more likely to fire. And we know that from neuroimaging, much of it performed by the Imperial College team, that this generates a more kind of fluid and dynamic state in the brain. Neurons are more likely to fire. They share information more freely. And so the world, this world model that your brain is always constructing, is kind of disrupted and becomes, Robin Carhart-Harris refers to it, this is the entropic state. So the brain is kind of nudged away from this finely tuned and balanced level of order to a slightly more disordered state. And this matches the kind of subjective experience you get with most psychedelics. The world starts to shift and change, and objects change their and morph and change their identity before the eyes. Everything becomes more fluid, as well as your thinking. And this kind of matches this idea that psychedelics are kind of shifting the brain into this slightly disordered state. But what's interesting with DMT is that you seem to transcend that. So the brain goes into this slightly disordered state as kind of the initial phases of the experience, and then it kind of collapses into this entirely new order, as if you can imagine twisting the dial on one of these old radio sets, and at first it becomes starts to crackle and becomes noisy, and then suddenly, when you kind of find a new channel and you get this crisp, clear new channel, completely different to the one you left behind, and that's kind of what's happening with DMT. Is for some reason, and this is the great mystery in my opinion, is the brain suddenly stops constructing its normal model of the environment that it's learned and evolved to construct, and starts constructing this entirely unrelated world that is far more complex, far more dynamic, and yet completely coherent, and exquisitely detailed. It's like the brain has suddenly switched to speaking a different language that it never learned to speak.
More so, more coherent, more detailed than the worlds that are sometimes summoned into consciousness by psilocybin, by LSD. I mean, entity encounters, I think, are much more common with DMT, the encounter with sentient entities, but I don't think they're limited to DMT.
That's correct. Yes. I mean, certainly with high dose psilocybin, particularly, I mean, very high doses. So when you get into the 5, 10 dried gram, the kind of McKenna's
Right.
heroic
Super
dose level.
doses, yes. And we'll take that moment to pay tribute to the late great Terence McKenna.
Of
And of
course.
course, it's from his quotation that you've taken the title of your book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the original title, which you saw, but I won't say what it was. It was not as good. And I was writing my book proposal actually for Peter, our editor, the phrase came up in the book proposal, and I thought, oh, I put in brackets, oh, that could be a good title. And in the end, it feels like that's the only possible title for the book, because that was, Terence McKenna was foundational to my thinking about DMT, and to most people's. Most people hear
And
about
mine.
DMT and yours, and
Yes.
so it's like, and that's one of his most famous coinages, was this death by astonishment is the kind of the only risk with DMT. And so, yeah, it's
Somebody asked him what are the risks of taking DMT or something like
yes.
that.
Exactly. And he said the only danger is death by astonishment, which really encapsulates DMT, I think. I think most people cannot comprehend. Most people are never really astonished, truly astonished. And DMT will deliver that every time.
It is truly astonishing. I mean, I've worked with it much less than you, but I've had the privilege of I don't know, maybe 20 DMT experiences over the years, and it remains utterly astonishing, and also slightly alarming. Maybe that's to do with sort of personal baggage that I carry. I don't know. I always feel slightly anxious before going into the DMT realm, and then have the security of knowing that I'll be out of it again pretty quickly. But once in there, I'm theirs. It seizes you in a way that nothing else I've ever experienced does.
Yeah, I mean, even Terence McKenna used to say that, used to describe the shaking hand around the pipe. I mean,
Yes.
it never goes away with me as well. I mean, certainly not. I mean, if you're not anxious before you do DMT, then I don't know, there's something not right up there, in my opinion. And it is.
I agree. It ranks alongside, one of those great and slightly edgy and life adventures, I think. The curious thing, one of the curiosities about DMT, and again paying tribute to Terence McKenna and also tribute to the peoples of the Amazon rainforest, who really have been the primary researchers in this field, for thousands and thousands of years, discovering the properties of these plants. Of course, the other way I've experienced DMT, as I'm sure you have, is in the ayahuasca brew. And this raises an interesting point, because there is this miraculous molecule widely available in nature, which interacts in astonishing ways with human consciousness, and yet is not orally active. So the Psychotria viridis leaves that contain the DMT, and I think the Chaliponga vine also contains DMT in its leaves. These cooked into a tea would not be psychoactive at all, and they have to be mixed with the ayahuasca vine. So first of all, tribute to the Amazonian peoples for figuring that out, and secondly, you know, that adds an extra layer of mystery to this whole thing, the interrelationship between plants bearing DMT and plants bearing the monoamine oxidase inhibitor that shuts down the enzyme in the gut that would normally destroy DMT. Talk a bit about that. It's such a weird thing that's got found at all, and that the mechanism works that way.
Yeah, and it was a long road from getting... So ayahuasca, I mean, it goes by... I think like 50 different names, depending on how big on the group, it's countless. But it was first, Carpi is another one. And this was first discovered by, shall we say, Western science in 1852, mm-hmm. By Richard Spruce, the great British botanist, who was at a party of sorts, where they were all taking lots of different drugs. And one of them happened to be this Carpi brew. And he had one cup and basically almost vomited and didn't want any more. But he
was that a brew only of the ayahuasca vine, or was it a brew of the two ingredients?
It's a good question. So in his field notes, he describes the vine. He focuses on the vine. He's told that this is the key component, but he also describes this other leaf, which is sometimes added, which he kind of didn't think that was that important. It probably was chacruna, but he didn't know.
It's clear that he was thinking chacruna or something similar. That makes sense. And did it have psychoactive effects on him?
It didn't have, he didn't describe any effects. I think he was given two cups of the brew, but he only got one down, and then he kind of he dashed to his hammock for a lie down.
And ayahuasca will do that. But the idea amongst peoples in the Amazon is very interesting. Is that the controlling spirit is the ayahuasca vine, and that it's somehow making use of the leaves of the DMT to almost to access human consciousness. And this thought leads me to what I think is I regard as the very big idea in your book Death by Astonishment, which is that that our species has been in interaction, a kind of interactive dance, often unknowingly, with a vast alien intelligence. And of course, the moment we use the word alien, all kind of bells get rung. But a vast alien intelligence has been in contact with our species, whether we know it or not, for millennia. And then secondly, your proposal is that if we want to understand, and this is a very bold proposal, that if we want to understand this vast alien intelligence that we are, like it or not, in interaction with better, if we want to understand it better, then DMT is potentially an incredibly effective tool to do that. So talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, clearly these indigenous groups for hundreds, thousands of years, they take these intelligences very seriously. And as far as they're concerned, I remember that at the Tyringham Symposium we were at in 2015, and Jeremy Narby, who I mentioned at the beginning of the book, described the Ashaninka tribe, and who talk about these Maninkari beings who they see as members of their tribe. They see them as real as any other individual within their social group, but they need certain tools to access them, sort of visual prostheses that allow them to see and interact with these beings. And so they've had a relationship with these beings. Now, we might call them spirits, anthropologists often do, but they will generally not use that word. It's a very Western word.
Hold that thought, because
Go
there's
on.
just an interesting side thought here,
Yeah.
which is that anthropologists and archaeologists who claim to deeply respect the views of indigenous peoples never, so far as I know, never take seriously the view that those spirits are actually real entities, you
Of
know. And
course.
if we're going to respect the views of indigenous peoples, we need to actually listen to what they say. And there's been too little of that in archaeology and anthropology. But carry on.
Yeah, I mean I mean obviously they assume that this is just mythology, but it's a weird kind of mythology where, I mean, mythology that's kind of promulgated in books and, you know, teachings or whatever, that's easier to kind of dismiss, if you like. But when you have intelligences, beings that they have the whole, it's part of their whole world view, and they have different types of beings they interact with regularly, and they're not just, it's not just part of a mythos, but it's actually, these are beings that they are interacting with. They take these plant-based pharmacological technologies, and which is what they are. Ayahuasca is not just a drug, it's not just a plant-based mixture, it's a true pharmacological technology that they have developed to interact with these beings. So they've been interacting with these beings, and I don't, yes, anthropologists might call them spirits. They call them something else. And in the modern era, we might call it a discarnate entity, or even some kind of non-human discarnate intelligence. I don't think the terminology matters so much. The important thing is that you've got some normally unseen discarnate intelligence. That's the key, that to us is very much alien. And certainly with DMT, I don't think that's a misnomer at all to refer to this as alien. But I think we're talking about the same kinds of intelligences. And even in the descriptions of these, I mean, the Hecuda beings, these multitudinous, lively, giggling beings that the Yanomami talk about and are absolutely central to their worldview, these sound a lot like elves. And the
What we
elves,
call, right, Mr. Terence, what we call machine elves,
or machine elves, as Terence would call them, and people like to blame McKenna for that and say, oh, it's people are only seeing elves because McKenna told them they're going to see elves. No.
Absolutely not.
These beings have been, you know, they're centuries, or if not millennia, people have been interacting with these beings.
I went into that in some depth in my 2005 book, Supernatural, recently republished as Visionary. And the conclusion I came to is that reports down the ages are the result of construal of these encounters. And when we construe an encounter, we inevitably do so within the cultural context of our time. I think it was Jacques Vallée who met, you know, first made the connection with aliens and fairies, you know, that at one or elves, that at one time Western culture was encountering entities that sound a lot like the entities that are being encountered today and construed as aliens. So my sense is that we're encountering the same phenomenon and construing it through different cultural lenses in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And you know, even to so another being that the Yanomami interact with are called the Warusinari, which are insect-like beings. And yet again, this is one of the most commonly reported entity types, are these insectoid, mantid, alien beings. And of course, they feature in abduction accounts and other entity encounters that people have without DMT. So I think it's like there's this thread running through the history of humanity, of people interacting with these beings, and the peoples of Amazonia, particularly the shamanistic cultures of Amazonia, they were the ones that discovered the tools to reliably access these intelligences that we kind of rediscovered in the 20th century with DMT. And we're kind of charged now, as I put it in the book, with kind of carrying it forward and saying, okay, can we improve upon this? Now we've discovered, once we take it seriously,
yeah, we're almost the latest carriers of that shamanistic cup,
exactly.
Which itself is being delivered to us in an already highly sophisticated and evolved form, entirely as the result of the work and deep intuitive understanding of indigenous peoples in places like the Amazon rainforest. But now the cup comes to Western technology, and what are we doing with it? I'm actually very intrigued, and I want you to talk about this, that the DMTX, the extended DMT work that's being done, seems to me, if I understand it correctly, a bit different from research that's being done into other psychedelics, which is primarily motivated by looking for therapeutic outcomes. Mm. Whereas, if I understand it correctly, the DMT research, DMTX research, is looking at, well, what do these encounters actually mean? What is going on here? It's more trying to investigate what it means for consciousness and the mystery, and the mystery of these experiences. And in that sense, it's different from other scientific approaches to psychedelics. Am I correct in that summary? Where now is work being done with modern volunteers and DMT? Where is it currently being done, if it is indeed currently being done?
Well, the original aim, when I myself and Rick Strassman first proposed DMTX, this repurposing of this technology from anesthesiology to kind of maintain a stable DMT brain, DMT concentration, so that you can induce somebody into the DMT state and hold them there. Our original aim, or my original aim at least, was so that we could properly, so people could spend time within the space and properly analyze it, perform experiments within the space, and establish and maintain some kind of communicative relationship with the intelligences within the space. Now, I can't say that all the groups working with DMTX have that same agenda, and that, or they certainly wouldn't say that publicly, because of course they're somewhat beholden to funding bodies and not being ridiculed. So I think
we're not supposed to be exploring the nature of reality.
No, we've worked that all out, Graham. Don't you know that? Yes, we know all about the nature of reality. So this is just analyzing neural activity and that kind of thing. But I think you're going to see, hopefully, more and more scientists start to take seriously. I mean, there is a push, certainly by Chris Timmerman, for example, who was at Imperial College, who's now moved to UCL to establish his own group. There is a push to kind of understand what's going on in the brain when someone takes DMT and why is it able to achieve these effects. But it's my contention that these will always fall short. I don't think they can fully explain DMT, certainly just use it by looking at patterns of neural activity. I think they're going to hit a wall there. So hopefully more and more scientists...
Because that's fundamentally, in a way, seeking to, once again, to reduce everything to matter. It's a sort of materialist reductionism, again, explain something by patterns of brain activity rather than what those patterns of brain activity are revealing to the experiencer.
Right. I mean, there is a lot you can learn from these patterns of neural activity and some very intriguing effects. I mean, a paper was just published by Timmerman, or at least his group, just a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, where they showed that the brain becomes much more sensitive to being perturbed by external information. And that was precisely the kind of What I hypothesized was that DMT is making the brain highly sensitive to being commandeered by this intelligent agent, to use the most neutral term for these intelligences. And this is what the data is showing. And Timmerman before also a very, very intriguing study where when a subject had their eyes closed and was injected with the DMT, the pattern of neural activity was identical to vision. You could see the waves of activity flowing into the brain, even though the eyes were closed. And it was like, oh, where does this information come from? And of course they would say, oh, it's just spontaneous neural activity. But that didn't.
That comes down to a fundamental mystery that we, I think, do not even begin to approach the answer to, which is, in raw terms, is consciousness generated or manufactured by the brain, or is it perhaps received by the brain? And we get this interesting analogy. Rick Strassman has used it between the TV set and the TV signal. You know, the signal can exist independently of the set, if you see what I mean.
Precisely, and
It's easy for materialist, reductionist-minded scientists to just reduce all of this to matter, and yet it's so hard to explain the personal experiential content of what is going on, and why this highly refined instrument created by billions, well, certainly in last anatomically last common ancestor with chimpanzees was about 6 million years ago, and there's millions of years of mammalian evolution before that. But this instrument, the human brain, that it can suddenly come up with all of this. I find that every time it happens to me, I find that really hard to believe. Where the fuck is this stuff coming from? It
Right.
does feel like it's coming in. At the same, the moment I say that, I can see the rolling eyes and the clucking tongues of the skeptics. But as you rightly say, they should be encouraged to receive the glass pipe and then express their opinions on the matter.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's the whole basis of my argument here. But I try to break it down and analyze and deconstruct and think deeply. I can't just say, oh, I don't believe that the brain can fabricate this, but I have to
No.
explain why I don't believe that. And that's a lot of the book, a chunk of the book is basically saying, no, these aren't hallucinations, these aren't
Very
dreams.
important chunk of the book. Very
Yeah, very
important.
important chunk of the book, I
It's
think. And
so essential to come at this at this seemingly very wild and out there set of ideas, to come at it from a very grounded point of view. And that's something I wanted to ask you. You as a voice in this field, offering this unique take on it. Why should people listen to you? What's your background? What's your own personal experience? Why are you in a place to talk about this authoritatively, which perhaps somebody else wouldn't be? Why should we listen to Andrew Gallimore? A deliberately provocative question.
Like Paxman. Yeah. Well, I mean,
I want to know I'm in good hands.
I'm not one of these guys that says, look at my credentials. I mean, I could talk about my PhD from Cambridge University and stuff like that. A lot of people like to do that.
Please do just a little bit.
Just a little bit, but that's not really the point. The point is, I offer my ideas, and I think what I do offer is I kind of tread this fine line between kind of orthodox, proper, credentialed scientist who does understand the neuroscience, who does understand the pharmacology, and has spent many years studying and training to reach that level. But is also not afraid to say, actually, can reach out into territory that other people fear to tread, really. And I think on the other side, you have the more mystical and spiritual people who will come at it from a completely different perspective. And I think most people, it's easier to dismiss somebody who says, okay, it's a type of spirit that you're interacting with, or a spirit of the plant, or it's a demon, or whatever. And this might be, in one aspect, true. If we regard a spirit as being just, you know, a discarnate intelligence, then perhaps in a way they're right, but it's not anchored to science. It's not anchored to what we know about, you know, how the brain works and things like this. Whereas I can do that, I can talk. People take me seriously, I guess, is because I never, you know, I spend 80%, I would say, of my work is not telling people about that what DMT is or what it represents, but actually it's eliminating, deconstructing, and analyzing the more mainstream orthodox models and saying, hey, this doesn't work. This is why. And that leaves that space where we have to think, okay, well, if this doesn't work, if it's not a dream, if it's not a hallucination, if it's not archetypal imagery, then what is it? And
Yes.
that's where I have that, I leave my spec myself that 10, 20% of space to speculate. But I speculate very carefully,
Yeah.
and I don't just jump
That's the
to
right way. That's the
conclusions.
right way to the right way to do it. I mean, what it means is that one of the easy techniques that skeptics use to dismiss extraordinary ideas is to call it pseudoscience. But they can't really call you a pseudoscientist because you are a genuine scientist, right?
They've tried.
Yeah. That's one of the first buzzwords. Pseudoscientist and conspiracy theory. These are
Grifter,
these
that's
words
another one.
are weaponized and wheeled out. Grifter, oh God, yes, all the time. All the time. But I think the point I want to drive home is that your work, your book, and it's not your first book, is the result of years of study and investigation of this subject, of innovation, of the DMTX technology, which I want you to talk about a little bit more, and also of personal experience. And since we're fundamentally with DMT and any of these extraordinary molecules, it boils down to personal experiences. That's the only we okay. We do have the data of changing brain wave patterns in the brain. We have that raw physical data, but it's the experience that is at the heart of this. And whether that experience can easily be dismissed as just an epiphenomenon of brain activity, I don't think it can be, and I know you don't think it can be, and I think you've made a powerful case in your book for why it cannot be just an epiphenomenon of brain activity.
I mean, there's kind of I was speaking to Matt Bell, who I know you saw in Florida,
Yes, yeah.
and he was asking me about, you know, how sure am I that this is something that we're interfacing with some kind of intelligence. And I said, I can give you two answers. One answer is I know, you know, I've known from 30 seconds after my first lungful of DMT vapor 20 odd years ago. I knew then, that this was not, this was, it was undeniably apparent to me, and I'm sure you felt the same. I mean, but then
Absolutely.
again, on the other hand, I realize that that's not enough if I want to actually convince other people that this is something worth taking seriously. So then I have to think, well, the other answer is, well, I think the evidence shows, and the neuroscience, and, you know, through my analyses, my sort of quote unquote objective analysis of the phenomenon, I'm still 60, 70, 80% sure that we're dealing with some kind. I lean heavily, I often say, towards the idea that we're dealing with some kind of intelligence. So both are true. I'm both completely sure and also fairly sure.
Fair enough. Have your ideas on this matter? I mean, as you say, from that first encounter, there's this very powerful sense of a connection with an intelligence that is somehow very other. But presumably, your ideas on all of this have evolved as a result of the experiences of volunteers in the various experiments or studies that are taking place around the world. Could you just outline for me what Where is actually DMT being studied at the moment? Is it still being studied at Imperial College in London? Right in mid-2025?
That's a good question. I think so that the last study that they did was the DMTX study, which was a pilot study in like a dozen volunteers for 30 minutes. But then Chris Timmerman left Imperial College at
Mm,
UCL. He's, I think
I
he's
didn't
shifting attention towards 5-MeO DMT. So
know
I'm
that.
not,
Another fascinating
yeah, so I'm not
medicine.
100% sure. I know that Matthias Liechti in Basel has done 90 minutes with DMTX, and I think on the west coast of America as well, there's some group, maybe in San Diego, I'm not quite sure they're doing
Help me
it.
to understand here.
Yeah.
DMTX, there seem to be two ways of putting people into an extended DMT state with modern science. And one of them you've been involved in inventing is the system that was used at Imperial College, the one that you and Rick Strassman created, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, it's the same principle. So we, the system that myself and Rick proposed really was really a proof of principle model. We were basically trying to show that DMT had these requisite pharmacological properties that would make it amenable to this target-controlled intravenous infusion, but it wasn't kind of human ready, so to speak. So the Imperial team improved upon the mathematical model to get it ready into humans, but it's all the same thing. It's target-controlled intravenous infusion. So yeah, that's basically what DMTX is.
I've heard that there's a study or an intended study at the University of California at San Diego. Is that right?
That's what I've
Or is
heard.
it new? But that's not happening yet. It would be very interesting to know. You're probably best placed to speak on this. Where right now is research into DMT going on, scientific research? And I ask that question because it's interesting. The extended DMT idea is precisely the idea that the ancient peoples of the Amazon came up with when they found a way to make DMT orally accessible by mixing it with the ayahuasca vine. The only downside, or actually it's often viewed as an upside in the Amazon, is the purging and the vomiting and the diarrhea, which are a bit of a distraction. Whereas with your DMT infusion idea, you can the effect of the orally accessible DMT and ayahuasca is a very long journey, 4 or 5 hours before you really start to reconnect completely with this physical realm. Whereas, as we know, the effect of smoked or vaped DMT is extremely fast. It's onset is instant, pretty much instant, and it's over in 10 or 15 minutes or less.
Yeah.
And my experience has always been with the smoked or vaped DMT. On the one hand, relief that I'm out of there and on so quickly, and on the other hand, I wish I'd been in there longer to learn more about this.
Yeah.
In the case of ayahuasca, you're in there for longer, but you're constantly distracted by the physical effects. So DMTX sounds like a great way to investigate the mystery of this medicine.
Yeah, I mean, what's
I just
interesting.
wish there was somewhere, sorry to interrupt, I just wish there was somewhere where, I could personally enroll as a volunteer in a proper scientific study. I did try to at Imperial College in London, but I was hit by a very bad epileptic attack in 2017. And you have to admit to medical conditions before you get signed up as a volunteer in these things. And apparently the fact that I had this sudden late onset epilepsy rules me out for participating as a volunteer in DMTX experiments. But if you know of any more DMTX work that's being done in any accredited university, I would love to have another chance to be considered as a volunteer.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, we have this, as you are aware, where we have this special license. So I work with New Nautics and a company called Eleusis, who are actually building out a retreat stroke research center in the Caribbean, St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And we have a special license from the government there to work with DMT. And in fact, pretty much any other psychedelic molecule that we want, but that's kind of our flagship. DMTX is going to be our flagship program.
Is that happening now?
It's happening. Hopefully, the plan is towards the end of the year, this will be kind of ready to go. So it will be a 5-star. It will be very different to a standard research institute or a university
Good.
where you lie in a hospital bed. It's
Yeah,
going to
this
be.
horrible, horrible, horrible setting, a hospital bed.
Yeah.
And the setting is an incredibly important part of the unfolding experience. So good news that it would be in a more nurturing setting.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got Carl Smith, who
Are you saying there's a chance I could go and volunteer there?
that's precisely what I'm saying. Yes, because
Because I don't think the epilepsy is a risk. Because I just, first of all, I'm sovereign over my own body, and secondly, I've worked with smoked and vaped DMT quite a bit since I had epilepsy, and it's had no negative effects on me whatsoever. So I'd be interested in the deeper immersion that this provides. And
yeah.
coming to, tell me about, in shorthand, the experiences that you know of some of the volunteers who have been through the DMTX process. What kind of encounter? I know that the sort of quest for the sentient other. There's even a group called the Sentient Others. I think it's a Facebook group or whatever. What exactly is going on with all of this now?
Well, so the only kind of trip reports, if you like, from DMTX
Yeah.
available were from the Imperial team, and of
And that's
the
about a dozen trip reports.
a dozen people, but only Carl Smith, Professor Carl Smith, who you also know,
I know
and
Carl.
you know Carl. He was the only one that managed. They had 5 sessions, I think, over several weeks, and he was the only one that completed all 5 sessions. I mean, that just kind of, and he's a serious psychonaut. I mean, this guy has some experience, to say the bloody least. So it just shows you how intense this experience is.
How much you have to brace yourself for it,
Yeah.
and others didn't go through with the whole program.
Yeah, and he. What was kind of interesting is because it was 5 separate DMTX sessions, he was obviously going back into the DMT world each time, and he was meeting up with the same entities, who were aware that he was returning, and eventually he got the sense that they were saying to him, "Oh, not you again," kind of feeling. Like, so it's not just something that it seems like it's not just an interaction that your brain is fabricating on the spot, but it seems to be this kind of longitudinal. It continues going on. These beings continue in their existence in your absence. Then you pop back in, and they're waiting for you. And they seem to be confused, he said, because when they did the scanning thing, the Imperial team did the scanning thing. With some fMRI or whatever, and the entities were apparently somewhat confused because they're normally the ones that do the scanning, and he's whereas it was the Imperial team and the humans on the other side who were doing the scanning.
Fascinating.
So it just shows you that there seems to be this real potential for establishing some kind of relationship with particular types of entities, or even specific individual entities who you can, and I hear stories of people, and this wouldn't be a surprise, of course, to the indigenous peoples, because they do establish relationships with these beings over very long periods. Often their entire lives, a shaman will be interacting with the same beings, but for us, of course, it's much more surprising or shocking to this post-enlightenment
First of
mind.
all, we have to overcome a massive cultural prejudice, which is that this is simply impossible, that science says this is impossible, which in fact science doesn't and cannot say. It can't say that it's impossible. And the work that's being done is beginning to suggest more and more that it is possible. But let's suppose that your big idea is right, that in a sense the DMT is reaching out to us as much as we're reaching out to it, or it's some sort of mutual process that it's connecting us with. Is it a single vast intelligence, or is it a multiplicity of intelligences that it's connecting? Let's explore that hypothesis a little bit further.
I mean, with my with my first DMT experience, I didn't see intelligences. I didn't see a multiplicity of them. I didn't see any visual beings, and yet the whole space seemed to be. It's hard. It's hard to explain, as you well know. But I know. I was reading your trip report from your first DMT trip in Supernatural, and I quote it in the book actually. And you said the same thing as me, basically, is that it was this very non-human intelligence that was undeniable. Yeah, and whether
Quite
it's one.
cold in some ways. There's that sense about it. It's not cruel. It's just like, or even indifferent. It's a very strange. There's always an emotional tenor to any encounter with sentient beings, and there is to this encounter as well. It's a very, very, very curious thing. But what would the outcome be if you're right, and we managed to use the amazing molecular technology of DMT, combined with harnessing very valuable, as a result of thousands of years of experience, shamanistic techniques, and modern science. If we get some kind of breakthrough, and we get to the point where even the most hard-headed materialist reductionist would have to say, actually, you are contacting something real. What would that real thing be? What would it be good for us? Is it something we should be doing, that we should be seeking out as a species? Or are we? I get the sense that you use the word alien intelligence, but it seems to me that you're more talking about an interdimensional, I'm using whatever language is out there, an interdimensional connection rather than a this universe connection. It's not an intelligence that we're ever going to find in spaceships, even if they approach the speed of light. It's something other than that. What is going to be the outcome of expanding and developing that connection?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because I think it's
You know, it's
almost.
Pandora's box. It's like when our species invented nuclear weapons, we opened the Pandora's box. And what's reassuring to me is the thousands of years of constructive shamanistic contact with these entities, which suggests to me that whatever the outcome might be, there's a good chance it will be positive. But we truly don't know for sure.
No, and I think it's hard to even imagine the transcendentally transformative implications of humanity recognizing that not only are we not alone, but that we're really not alone. that there are intelligences that are incomprehensibly more intelligent than us and more advanced, and that we can access them. Anyone can access them. This is not, you don't need advanced technologies to access these beings. Anyone who can source one of the many plant, abundant plant sources can access this intelligence. It's incredibly beautifully democratic in a way. You don't need permission. You don't need special equipment. All you need is a glass pipe, and you can access them. And then I almost struggle to get past. It's like a black hole. It's like an epistemic black hole. It's like, what does humanity look like when we know, when everyone, it becomes common knowledge that there are not just alien beings on far-flung star systems that are billions of light years away that we never have to worry about, but actually there are intelligences that are right here, right now, everywhere and nowhere. That requires a fundamental shift in how we see reality and how we see our place within reality. Currently, we see ourselves as being at the top of the tree. We have control. We have dominion over the earth and dominion over reality. We understand the origins of the universe. We understand all of this stuff and how everything works. And then DMT within 30 seconds obliterates. It's all gone. Our understanding is makes nothing makes sense anymore. And I think that to get past that and look past that, it's like trying to peer into a black hole. I just don't think. I think the answer is that we learn, once we accept that these intelligences are there, we learn how to spend time with them, spend significant portions of our lives interacting with these intelligences without assumptions as to what they are or where they're from or anything like that, and simply spend time and learn from them what that yeah. learning might look like and how it might, the implications for our future development as an intelligent species, what that means. I don't think we know, and I think we're only going to find out by accepting that these are true intelligences and then learning from them.
And Western science, although it offers so much wonderful potential, is doesn't provide a reference frame for us to integrate these experiences. What does provide a reference frame are the accumulated experiences of shamanistic cultures over thousands and thousands of years, whether documented in their art or in their myths and traditions. The very direct matter of fact day-to-day connection with otherworldly beings. And again, this is where the sneering skeptics need to pause, because those self-same sneering skeptics, as I said at the beginning, claim to be the champions of indigenous peoples' rights. And the first and foremost right is to be believed. And it's odd that most of those so-called champions of indigenous people's rights do not have any respect for the notion of discarnate intelligences. And they think that's just a fantasy that somehow has been maintained for thousands and thousands of years until wise, all-powerful Western scientists came along and debunked it. What utter rubbish. How little we know as a species, how much we have to learn, and how important it is in the right ways to accept the invitation that DMT is offering to us. There are people who shouldn't take DMT, I suspect. Do you have any views on that? I don't want us to be, you know, to be irresponsibly saying, everybody go take DMT. I think my first view on that is actually, If you are considering DMT, be extremely cautious and careful. Investigate this. Look into it in the same sort of depth that you might look into a first skydiving or a first deep scuba diving adventure. Look into it because there are risks. And if you're emotionally and mentally fragile, and particularly, it has to be said, if you're on any kind of antidepressant, these substances are not necessarily helpful. The serotonin syndrome is something to look out for. And one thing I would counsel anybody, whether exploring DMT or any of the other tryptamines, is be off an antidepressant for at least 6 months before you go there.
Yeah, I mean, what is remarkable about DMT is, I mean, physiologically, I mean, assuming you are not on any other medications, or certain medications are an issue, as you mentioned, you know, monoamine oxidase inhibitors are often used in as antidepressants, and they can cause serious problems. But assuming you're not on any other kind of medications of that type, DMT has shown itself to be physiologically benign, and in fact potentially even beneficial neurologically. And so Terence McKenna wasn't far off when he said that death by astonishment is perhaps the only risk, but that was a real warning. He wasn't he wasn't joking, in a sense. These aren't party drugs. This isn't a party drug, I should say. These are extremely bizarre, shocking, in many senses, for most people, first time will be horrifying, appalling. Just, you can't expect to go there and come back unchanged. You know, it is going to change you fundamentally, particularly if you have specific views about the nature of reality, particular religious beliefs. And that takes me back, you were just mentioning of the kind of lack of respect for indigenous beliefs, and it's often you get these people who will happily entertain the idea of some invisible God that you can't see, but
Yes.
you're promised the face-to-face audience upon death or something who's going to judge you and then send you to heaven or hell. That's
Yeah.
fine to believe that, but the idea that these are beings you can actually communicate with, they're like, look,
Yes.
take this. I'm not just telling you.
Yeah.
Here, take this fucking drug, and then you will
Yeah.
see it yourself. It's like,
And you will have the experience, and
yeah.
then you as a sovereign adult can make up your own mind about the experience and decide whether to explore it further in depth or not. I mean,
Yeah.
our society is so screwed up around the whole the very word drug itself
Yeah.
carries so much baggage. It's often used, but when people attack my work, one of the first things they do is attempt to drug shame me and say that Hancock is, takes ayahuasca or DMT or whatever. It's a very emotionally laden issue in our society, and we need to deconstruct that. And I love the way that you're seeing DMT as a molecular technology, and that far from involving trillions of dollars in exploring what is fundamentally near Earth space, because we do not have the technology for interstellar travel. Far from doing that, we'd be in better to invest, a tiny fraction in exploring this inner space and see if it leads to another kind of space altogether, and find out if that's real. Maybe it's been the source of all human inspiration down through the ages. Terence was right, food of the gods. This is the fundamental idea that our ancestors were got locked in a particular narrow track, and it was encounters with psychedelics that knocked us out of that track and opened us up to other things. So in a way, by demonizing these substances, our society is doing itself a disservice. And that's not to say don't be careful. I do say this every time. Anybody who wants to explore these medicines, be careful, do your research as you would with any serious matter. But fundamentally, this should be a matter of the sovereign decisions that individual adults make. Psychedelics are not for children, in my view, certainly not in our society. I know that there are some Amazonian tribes who give ayahuasca to kids almost at birth, as a kind of initiation, a teaspoon for it. But this would not work in our society. We don't have the wise shamanistic context in which to set that. But it's from the shamans of this world, it's from the indigenous peoples of the Amazon rainforest and other indigenous cultures that we will learn how better to negotiate the DMT realm, in my view.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing. I mean, in the book, as you know, I spend a lot of time talking about the indigenous peoples, and
Yeah.
the first half of the book, or first quarter of the book, I describe, how Western science struggled to kind of make sense of these technologies that these groups had developed hundreds of years ago, and remarkable combinations of drugs that like synergistically interact in the brain in order to kind of potentiate their effect. These weren't just things thrown together, but these are true technologies that have been developed, and in order to make these hidden beings visible. And I see this beautiful kind of the whole thing coming full circle now. In my book, I come from a completely different worldview, a completely different background, completely different culture, and yet through neuroscience and through pharmacology, I've reached the conclusion that we are dealing with some kind of discarnate intelligence, and that's precisely the conclusion that these indigenous peoples came to thousands of
Yeah.
years ago through entirely
Indeed.
different means. They, as you said, it was intuitive. They just knew, they understood.
Yeah.
Whereas it's taken us, we have to take an entirely different route, and yet we arrive in the same place. We're both
Yes.
talking about, we've got different words for it, but we're both talking about some kind of other, some
Yeah.
discarnate intelligent other with which we are interacting. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Me too. I absolutely agree, and I encourage everybody who's tuning into this, go get Death by Astonishment. It's an absolute breakthrough book. It's an
Thank you.
incredibly important book. I can't overestimate it enough. It is really, really important contribution to our understanding of the mysteries of being alive. So thank you, Andrew. Thank you for spending this time with me. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
No, I don't think so. But of course, yes, Death by Astonishment. Forward
Death by
by
Astonishment.
Sir Graham Hancock, of
Oh,
course.
yours truly. I'm honored that you asked me to write the foreword to the book. Most people know me because of my work on the possibility of a lost civilization of some sort during the Ice Age, but I've long had a parallel interest in psychedelics and the role that psychedelics have played in the development of human culture, which is truly enormous in my view and greatly underestimated.
Yeah, I mean, Supernatural is a classic in my opinion. I actually wrote in my book proposal that in a way, Death by Astonishment is kind of like the 21st century sequel to Supernatural. I mean, you explore many of the same ideas from a different perspective from
I think that's what we're all doing is we're building on ideas all the time. I was all in Supernatural was 2005 that was published. I was building on ideas there before that, and I think that's what's really healthy is that there's a constant refreshing and building of new information in this area, and it is an area of enormous importance. I know you're going to face skepticism and hostile critics. It's inevitable when you step into this area. But you can always offer them the glass pipe.
That's it.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much.